Now, there are a lot of ways in which you could probably think about detecting a debugger. For example, you can just list the processes active on the system to see if one of those processes match a well-known debugger. But the functionality built into FatBot, I think, is much more elegant. Because what FatBot does is it times to see how quickly it is being executed. And if it's running too slowly, that's probably because somebody is stepping through it using a debugger. I think that's just very clever. This will work with any debugger. Because if you're debugging it, you're probably slowing it down so that you can understand what it does. So if it executes too slowly, it'll give you this error message saying, routine took too long to execute, probably single step. Debugger active. Very clever. Now, what if you were writing a piece of software and you wanted to detect that it's running within VMware? Any ideas what would you look for? You would look at VMware devices that are specific to systems virtualizing VMware. Yeah, any other ideas? MAC addresses. VMware assigns its MAC addresses starting with a particular suffix, so you could see if those MAC addresses are being used. Any other thoughts? Say that again? See if you've got a local host, like a private address range. That might work, although VMware randomizes its address space that it assigns for private addresses, so it would look similarly to a real-world company behind the net. So that in itself might not be enough. But perhaps malware could check whether the system to which it's connecting is not on a publicly addressable address space. Maybe that's what you had in mind. Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yep, that's a possibility. Yep. Yeah, see if VMware tools are installed. That's right. Yeah. Yeah, it's fast, and I'm going to show you an example of that later on. Yeah. Yes. Memory addresses. That's a little bit more advanced, but people have found that systems that have been virtualized, their memory address ranges that are typically used are a little bit different from systems that are not virtualized. Yeah. Yeah. There are many ways in which malware can detect that it's being virtualized. Here's one more that we have not mentioned yet, and this one is used actually by a lot of malware. This is some assembly instructions that check for the presence of a particular I.O. port that is not present on non-virtualized systems. VMware uses this particular port number. It's not a network port, it's an I.O. port, a little bit different. It uses it for back-end communications. Let's say if you're sharing clipboard across virtual machines, if you move your mouse, it needs to know where the mouse movement should start and end. That kind of information is passed around behind the scenes, and there's a way for malware to check to see whether that communication path is currently active. Yeah. So what about tools that look for other hypervisors beyond VMware? Now, I tell you, VMware is just by far the most popular platform, so I personally have only encountered samples that use look for VMware, but some techniques could be generic to like the way memory address ranges are being used. I believe that technique works with just other tools beyond VMware. Yeah, you have seen some that look for Xen specifically. And do you remember how it was looking for Xen? Oh, fun. So Edward is saying that in his overseas work outside of the U.S., where Linux virtualization, I guess, is more popular than in the U.S., malware has looked for Xen, for the presence of Xen. Yeah. Similar experience, yeah. Yeah, okay, cool. Yeah. So in many cases, Kent is wondering, well, so how would I even look for malware that does this? Exactly what you're saying. You run it, and it exits. And you say, that's weird, and then you bring it into the physical system, and it doesn't exit. So you can spend a lot of time trying to locate that code that looks for the presence of virtualization and try to disable it. I'm going to show you an example of that on the last day of the class. When we're talking about it, I mean, the general concepts that we're discussing are in Book 1 around page 210. Yeah. You can spend a lot of time looking for code that locates VMware or virtualization, and I'll show you an example of that later in the course. But the reality is that code can be really time-consuming to find. So in most cases, what happens is you run it in virtualization, it crashes, You try it in physical, it doesn't crash. So you know what? You do that analysis in your physical lab, and that's that. Yeah. But I will show you how you can locate some of this code and try to disable it. Yeah. So John brings up an excellent point. He's asking, do I see a trend away from refusing to run in a virtualized environment? Because a lot of real-world production infrastructure, certainly servers, and in many cases a lot of workstations are starting to get virtualized. And I agree, absolutely. I think it will not make sense for malware to continue to refuse to run in a virtualized environment because everything will be virtualized, just like in the Matrix. So yeah, I think in the long term, it will not make any sense for malware to refuse to run in a VMware environment. That's why I'm not, yeah. So that's why I'm not too worried about this. Right now, a lot of organizations have moved to using physical infrastructure for their lab, but I think a few years from now, so much of the real world production systems will be virtualized that it'll be okay for us to use VMware again or any other virtualization tool. Yeah. So for the longest time, I was hoping somebody would create a tool that allows me to take my physical system and make it pretend like it's actually VMware. I don't have the programming skills to write such a tool, but for some time, you might make yourself immune to a lot of infections if your physical system pretends to be virtualized. But I think that'll stop being effective a few years from now because everything will be virtualized anyway. So this was a code excerpt from FatBot. Now, I mentioned that one of the ways to deal with malware that tries to detect that is being virtualized is, well, don't virtualize your lab, use a physical lab. Another way is to locate the code that detects the presence of VMware and try to disable it. I'll show you an example of that later on. And another approach was discovered by Tom Liston and Nat Scotus. And this approach makes use of some undocumented features that are available as part of VMware. When you launch a virtual machine in VMware, what you're really doing is it's equivalent to double-clicking on a file that has a VMX extension that describes the virtual machine. It's actually a text file. You can edit it with Notepad. And what Tom and Ed found out a couple of years ago is that you can add some undocumented options to that config file that will try to stealth the presence of virtualization in the virtual machine that you start up. So the options are on your screen. If you don't feel like retyping them, then the best thing to do is you look for the paper that Tom and Ed published. The URL is in your notes, page 211 in book 1. And you can just copy and paste from there. So when you add these options to your VMX files, a few things will happen. One is your virtual machine will be slow as hell. I mean, unbearably slow, really, really slow. That's the bad news. Another bad news is that a lot of the functionality that VMware brings you won't work. Like your resolution will, I think, default to VGA, really, really small screen, no colors, very slow mouse movement. So that's the bad news. The good news is that a lot of code that malware uses to detect that it's being virtualized, it won't work properly. Because, well, you have just disabled a lot of that functionality. VMware tools, of course, won't work either. So I thought I'd mention this to you because sometimes you can try to do this and it'll fool malware. I don't do this all the time because it makes VMware too slow. But it's something that's worth knowing. There was one example, for instance, there was this executable I wanted to analyze. It was called rss3.csse.exe. Double clicked on it in VMware, boom, it crashes. Well, it crashes. Is it maybe because it detects that it's running in VMware? So I added these options to the VMX file, rebooted my virtual machine, and now, guess what? It runs no problems. It infects my system. And, you know, how many times are you happy that malware actually infects your system? Well, this is one of those. It infected the system. I could do my analysis. And it was easy because of these features that are undocumented in VMware. Yes. So you're saying, but why bother using virtualization? Just use a physical system. A lot of companies just use a physical system. I mean, you can probably have some old server lying around that nobody else is using. You can dedicate to it. Absolutely. Some people like having their malware analysis lab mobile and portable. Some like the snapshot functionality, and so a lot of companies still end up using virtualization. But a lot of companies just don't want to bother with issues like this and use a physical system. Absolutely. Yeah, yeah, snapshot with Ghost or DD as we discussed yesterday. Yeah, that works. Alright, so a few more things I wanted to mention to you, because you will wonder, well, once this class is over, it's going to be sad, of course, and you will wonder, well, where can I continue learning about this sort of stuff? Right, because learning certainly won't stop. We won't cover some of the more advanced topics in this course. We just don't have that time. So a few pointers to learning resources. Some of these maybe you have seen before. Some of them maybe you haven't. I contribute to the Internet Storm Center website. Every day we publish some interesting findings, some threats that we have observed, and periodically we publish our analysis of some malware that people write to us about. So that's a good learning resource. A lot of the anti-malware, anti-virus vendors have blogs that are becoming really good at sharing with you some of the details about malware that they're seeing. And best of all, some of these blogs are really good at telling you what tools they're using. My favorite vendor-based blog is probably the one by WebSense. And the reason I can single out WebSense is because they're really good at telling you what tools they use to perform the analysis, so you can learn from them. A lot of the antivirus vendors are a bit more secretive about how they're doing their work. Yes. Can you download malware from these guys? Well, not from antivirus guys. It's a big no-no in the antivirus world to distribute malware. But there are plenty of other sources. Some of them are on this slide. These are discussion forums where you can read about malware analysis, contribute your thoughts, and as people get to know you, they can start sharing samples with you. So forums like RCE forums, Offensive Computing, OpenRCE, Reverse Engineering Community, this is where you can discuss what you're seeing, ask for advice, and in some cases people share samples. Certainly Offensive Computing, that Matt has the ability to, where you can download samples from them. The best way to get samples is probably to set up a honeypot of your own and just let one of your systems be infected and see what ends up on your box. Also, relatively new is the mailing list that I set up for alumni of this course. So it's a private mailing list only for people who have attended the course, and it's an opportunity, it's the only forum that I know set up specifically to talk about how to become a better malware analyst. So we're all learning on this forum. It's okay to ask stupid questions because it's probably not stupid. As you're seeing new tools, as you're wondering how to analyze certain things, we've had some really good discussions on this forum. And we're going to sign you up for it about a week after this course. But if you don't want us to even sign up on it, just let me know, and I'll tell Sense not to do it for you. But you can unsubscribe anytime you want. People have found it useful. If you do get subscribed to it, check out the archives. We've had some good discussions recently on that list. And also, in some cases, people ask for specific malware samples on that mailing list if you need a copy to research. Some books I thought I'd mention to you. There are some really good books being published. We're going to talk somewhat about assembly tomorrow, but of course, it's not going to be a course about assembly. This is my favorite book to learn assembly. Big, thick book, textbook style, textbook price tag, but it's okay if your company is covering the cost. If you want to learn about assembly, that's my favorite book to learn about x86 assembly. If you want to learn about how to disassemble malware, a few books. This is one of the more classic volumes, Hacker Disassembling Uncovered. It's really, it's a little bit dry, but it's a good technical resource. Another similar one is Reverse Engineering Code with IDA Pro. This is specifically if you're interested in how to do that in IDA Pro, the disassembler that we're going to touch upon in the course, but really we're not getting very deep into some of the really cool features that are part of IDA Pro. But my favorite IDA Pro book is this one. It came out was it that long ago? Well, this is my favorite IDA Pro book. So if you're going to buy one book to get to know IDA Pro, I'd recommend this one. The IDA Pro book is fantastic. Plus, it has a really cute cover, so you know it's going to be a happy experience for you. And also, one of my favorite books on the topic is Malware Forensics. Now, Malware Forensics takes a slightly broader approach to the topic than what we're covering in this course. They talk about some of the file system level forensics and how to look at processes and network connections of live infected systems. I think they do a really good job covering this topic here. And this is also one of my favorite books on understanding the heritage of malware, and specifically focusing on viruses. And viruses defined narrowly as malware that spreads itself and attaches itself to other programs. And Peter Zohr from Symantec Press does a fantastic job covering this topic. Really, really good book. And those are really the resources that I thought I'd share with you as opportunities for you to continue learning even after the class is over. So now I've allocated some time to reinforce the tools, the techniques, the concepts that we've been covering so far in the course. And these are the hands-on exercises that are in your book one, starting on page 227. There are three exercises, but realistically, you don't need to do number three because we already did it together in class. So yesterday, we went over the analysis of TNNBTIB. We did that analysis together. And now we're going to spend about 45 minutes or so. It's a chance for you, if you want to, go over those instructions and ask me any questions if something was not clear. But maybe even a better use of your time would be to focus on exercises number 4 and 5. The instructions in your book, but let me tell you a bit what these exercises are about. Exercise number 4 asks you to see whether it's possible to easily disinfect the system that was infected with TNNBTIB. You may remember that one of the strings embedded into TNNBTIB was the string remove. My question to you is, does this command really remove this malware sample? You know, when analyzing malware, I oftentimes look for the disinfection instructions because some of this malware can be really hard to get rid from the system. So when I look and I see an instruction that might disinfect my box, I'm going to see if it's effective at all. So my question to you is, does the remove command really work? The way to answer this question, I think, is not to do code analysis, but rather use something like RegShot. Take a snapshot of your system when it's infected, then allow the bot to join your IRC server, log into it, issue the remove command, take another RegShot snapshot, and see what did remove do? Does it really clean up your system? So that's this exercise, and I've got the instructions in your book for what you should be looking for. I've got some hints for you. And the other exercise that I think is a lot of fun is to answer the question, what is the deal with irc.slim.org.au? It's one of those three host names that it tries to resolve. My question to you is, what functionality is associated with this host name? You might guess that it's probably based on IRC. You're going to see that malware uses this host to join an IRC channel. But it's going to be a different channel than the one that we saw yesterday. Also, you can authenticate to malware. You can log into it from this server, but it's using a different password than the one that we saw before. What is the channel? What is the password? To answer these questions, you basically perform the steps that we did yesterday. But now you should be logged in from a channel on this server. The more detailed instructions for how to pursue this are in your book, around page 238, book 1. Take a look at it. Go through the steps. If anything is unclear to you, if you get stuck, I'm going to be here, ask me some questions, and we're going to allocate probably about 45 minutes to going through these exercises. And then together I'm going to go over the solutions. And now it's regarding Remnix, because a few people were asking, how do you change a resolution of your screen in Remnix? So one way to do it is to install VMware tools, and then it will auto-resize based on what your native resolution is. Another way, without installing VMware tools, is to use the command xrender, xrander. And if you run xrender without any parameters, it's going to show you all the resolutions that are supported, and it's going to put an asterisk next to the one that you're currently running. So I'm currently at 1024 by 768. If you want to switch your resolution, you type xrender-s, and then you specify which resolution you want. So let's say xrender-s, 800 by 480, let's say. Right? So if you want to change your resolution without installing VMware tools, xrender, and then xrender-s should do it. And this way, you can maximize your screen and fill it completely, especially after you switch into the full screen view. Okay, sure, yeah. Yeah, I appreciate all the feedback that you're giving me about what you like, what you don't like in an environment like Remnix. This particular conference is actually the first time I'm using it for exercises, so that's why it's very helpful for me to hear what things you want me to improve upon. So I'm probably going to give some tips as part of my future book revisions about how to do this. But if you want to do it now, it's xrender. going again. And at this point, I wanted to go over the solutions to the exercises that we've been working on. I think we've had good discussions, and I appreciate you asking questions whenever something is not clear or whenever you get stuck. That's why I'm here. I wanted to point you in the right direction. And where are we? All right, so the remove command. Did it work? Did the remove command work?
Yeah?
Yeah?
Sort of.
Kind of. It almost worked. And if you... Well, let's take a look at what you probably did and how you found out. I think the easiest way to answer this exercise question is to use the RegShot tool, take a snapshot of the system while it's infected, then issue the remove command, take another snapshot. And here's what I saw. I saw that malware does remove its registry entry. And also, if you looked at the task list, it does terminate its process. And the only thing that it doesn't do is that it still keeps tnnbtib in the Windows directory. So it deactivates itself, but that malicious file is still on the file system. So if you wanted to clean up your infection in the enterprise, now, it's mostly a theoretical concept. I have not spoken to organizations that have done this. But it is possible if you have a ton of systems in your enterprise infected with a bot like this. It is possible for you to use the techniques that we've discussed here to redirect those bots to one of your own controlling servers and then issue the remove command to disinfect your enterprise systems. A little bit risky. Most enterprises won't do it, but as a thought exercise, I think it's kind of fun to think about. If you wanted to clean things up in your enterprise in this particular scenario, you'd still have to have some kind of a follow-up script to delete the file that it leaves behind. It could have removed its own file. Yeah, certainly. So you're saying, well, it's running, so how can it remove its file? Won't Windows say that the file is in use? Yeah. The way malware does this is actually there's a standard technique for how malware can remove its own file. And let me show you how it works. I have an example for you. Look at the bottom of page 204 in your first book. And that's an example of a batch file that malware uses. That's very, very common to remove itself. Basically, what it does is it creates a temporary batch file, and the batch file has a loop, and that batch file tries to remove the malware executable. As soon as the malicious process terminates itself, that batch file will clean up the malicious program and then delete itself. So that's the very common technique for how malware removes its own executables. Actually, the batch file can remove itself as well. And batch files are able to remove themselves. Windows does not prevent that from happening. So if you look at the bottom of page 204, the last command is del 0. That's the batch file removing itself, yeah. So good question. Thanks for asking that. So that's the remove command. Now, what about the other one? irc.slim.org.au. Well, your network sniffer would show you that as soon as the malicious program is able to resolve this host name, regardless of whether you used fake DNS or host file, if it's able to resolve it and you point it to your Linux box, you would start seeing additional network traffic that you did not see before. And this, it looks like it's using port 666 for this connection. If you follow that TCP stream and your IRC server is running, you would notice that it's using channel Penix. Now, it is supplying a key to join that channel. In this case, the key is DLKA4MSD. In your lab, that key is not necessary. In your lab, the IRC server will automatically create the channel the first time somebody tries to use it, but it will not password protect it. So in your lab, that password is irrelevant. You would only need to use this password when joining this channel on the real world system in the wild. Now, if you join this channel, you can try to log into it. You would notice that it's expecting a different password. The malware password no longer works when you're trying to log in from the channel Penix. But if you follow the exact steps that we covered yesterday to set a breakpoint on that strcomp function and to trigger that breakpoint, you would notice that on the top of the stack, there's the password that it's looking for, which is DLKA4MSD. It happens to be the same password that it's using when joining the channel, but it could have been different. And of course, once you know the password, you can log in using that password. The two strings will match, and therefore, it's going to say pass accepted. And once the password is accepted, you can issue privileged commands like run. So, this particular program supports two different IRC servers, two different IRC channels, and the login command expects two different passwords depending on the channel from which you're connecting. Any questions about the approach that we've used to answer this particular set of questions? Well, the last step perhaps is maybe you're wondering, so where is it, where in this malicious file is the word slim? How does it know to use irc.slim.org.au? You can use XOR search. And if the attacker used this algorithm, you would be able to find the corresponding string. If you XOR search chnnbtib, the unpacked version of it, for the word slim, you would find that there is an encrypted version of the string protected using XOR key 89. And you might also wonder what other strings are embedded into this executable and are also protected using the same key. To answer that question, you invoke XOR search using the -s parameter. This way, not only will it find the key that protects slim, it'll also try using that key to decrypt other strings. And if you look at the resulting file, it'll create a file in the file system called chnnbtib.exe.xor.89. If you look at that file using bintext, you will start seeing some other interesting strings that are protected using the same key. Penix, DLK4MSD, that's how it knows what channel to join. We've got the key itself, DLKA4MSD, and also that's the key that's used to protect the referrer field and the webhop URL. Yes? Say that again? Ah, good question. You've noticed a string that we have not observed behaviorally before, sysupd.exe. What's that about? We have not seen it before, and your theory is that maybe that's the file name that it used when it originally dropped the file. It's a good theory. We're actually going to see it again in the future, so keep an eye out for sysupd.exe. Yeah, but a very good question. That's why I like trying XOR search, because it might reveal other strings that you have not seen before, and you can start investigating them if they're really important to you. So it's not uncommon for malware to use multiple IRC servers and channels. It's oftentimes used for resiliency. If one of its servers goes down, the attacker can use the other server to control his bot network. But that's not why it was being used here. So let me tell you a bit about this particular program. TNNBTIB is also known as Slackbot, and it's written by someone who calls himself or herself Slim. And some time ago, you could go to Slim's website, and you can actually download a copy of Slackbot. And it was very user-friendly. You didn't even need to compile anything because he didn't give you the source code. He had the compiled executable for you, and if you wanted to build up your own bot network, every child's dream, right? If you wanted to build up your own bot network, download his executable. He also gave you this configuration program that had a nice little GUI to it, and this is the program that you would use to customize the executable to connect to your own IRC channel on your own IRC server using your own password. And actually, that's the program that I used to customize this particular version of Slackbot. And all you gotta do is click save, and it's gonna embed this information directly into the executable. You don't even need to recompile anything. Very user-friendly, right? Now, on his website, he had a little message to people. He said, don't bother me about this. If you can't figure out how to use it, you probably shouldn't be using a computer. Have fun. Slim. And if you look in the notes to page 258 in your book, you will find the full usage information that he provided where he documented what commands are supported by this bot. So that's very nice of him, I guess, to just give out this bot to anybody who asks. But here's what's interesting. Nowhere in his website did he say anything about sb.webhop.org or irc.slim.org.au. So webhop. My theory is that webhop.org is the feature that it's using to pretend to click on advertisements. So Slim has all these people downloading his bot, building up their own bot networks, and what they don't realize is that every system that they infect is going to be making money for Slim, because that system is going to be pretending to be clicking on ads. Also, in a more devious twist, What these people don't realize is that Slim has his own IRC server, his own IRC channel, and his own password to take over all of these people's bot networks. So they think they're also elite building up their bot networks. Slim can take over all of them using his own password, DLKA4MSD. So kind of interesting, I thought, this backdoor having a backdoor in it. And I thought it'd be a fun thing for us to research, so that's why I have it here. Also, it gives us an opportunity to learn some really good things about malware and how to analyze it, and we're going to see it again this morning. So I'm going to open up my next slide deck, and this is going to be book two. Yeah. So Tim is talking about how a bot herder or a bot network operator wants to protect his own turf and wants to prevent his competition from taking over his bot networks, right? So you're right. They put up various stumbling blocks. In many cases, it is as simple as this. I mean, you see it. It's not encrypted. You see the bot network. In some cases, he will encrypt the traffic that he uses. For example, the example that I talked about on the first day, srvcp.exe, that one would have been harder to take over because his commands would not have been provided in clear text. He encrypted his commands. So if you were just observing the traffic, you wouldn't see things. It was encrypted. So you'd have to do a bit more analysis of the malicious executable to decrypt his command traffic. So yes, some bots are more complex than this, but many of them are as straightforward as this, because, you know what, there are just so many systems that can be easily owned. It's not a zero-sum game. People take over each other's bot networks, and if they fight, it's like people fighting for corners. Yeah. But they certainly build in various defenses to protect themselves against their competition, less so than from defenders of the systems. Well, I don't remember specifically the Mariposa botnet that you're referring to, but plenty of these bot networks. You've got one guy trying to find a vulnerability in another bot to take over those systems, and they try to push each other out, and there are definitely these turf wars that they engage in. I mean, good for us, but unfortunate for the victims, of course. Well, yeah, that's true. Yeah, because maybe that's just the strongest ends up surviving. All right, so here's what I want to cover this morning. I want to look at a few core topics. Some of them we'll cover this morning. Some of them we'll talk about after lunch. I'm going to talk about how to patch executables to change the flow of execution, to get them to do something different than what they're designed to do. I also want to talk about packed executables, how to deal with those. And lastly, we're going to cover in this section how to intercept network connections in your lab that use IP addresses rather than host names. So that's what awaits us in the first half of today. Patching executables. In this context, when I talk about patching executables, I mean modifying compiled executables to change what they do without having access to their source code. Now, this is very useful for a malware analyst to be able to do sometimes. And this is particularly useful in situations where you have malware that does something that you don't want it to do. For example, you have malware detecting VMware, or you have malware detecting only debug. If you can find the code that offends you, you can modify it so that it's no longer effective. I'm going to have some good examples of this on the last day of the class, but I'm going to introduce you to this topic within the context of TNNBTIB, just because we're already familiar with it.